Hi, good morning, everyone. I think we'll get started. I know we have another probably 20 people coming, but I am Dr. Nadia Millington. Most of you know me. I am the Deputy Director of the new Masters in Social Innovation. I'm also the Deputy Director of the Innovation Lab, and I'm also on the steering committee of the Latin America and Caribbean Center, because shock or shock, I'm from the Caribbean. And it's really exciting to be here today. But before we get started, I just want to recognize, before I actually speak about our amazing entrepreneurs who came from all parts of the world, including like flying in from Chile and also coming in from Cambridge. Wow, like really far, right? Treacherous journey, treacherous train right in from Cambridge. I want to recognize Dr. Harry Barkema. For those of you who don't know him, he is the director of the Social Innovation Program, and he's also the director of the Innovation Lab, and really a lot of what's going on in social innovation in LSE in an authentic way is driven by Harry, if I'm honest. So for those of you who don't know him, he's the shy one in the corner there who's like, just, Nadia, I can't believe. The other person that I would like to recognize is in here, which makes it rather interesting. But Professor Gareth Jones, just like Harry's a professor, he is from the geography department, and he's also been heavily involved in this conference. So let me just get started. Like every house, and I consider this our house, right, home of upcoming social entrepreneurs, in every house there are rules. And the rules of engagement are, please, your phones, can you put them on silent? I will manage the day to time. As you know, the morning session is going to be focused on successes. The afternoon session is shorter, but it's going to be focused on failures. This is all about the amazing social entrepreneurs, so you're not going to hear a lot of me. I'm just going to quickly introduce them and give them the floor to talk about their amazing organizations. And then we will have a bio break. So for those of you who desperately need to text, write, like really can't, you know, like you have that itchy trigger finger, you're going to have 20 minutes to 10, 15 minutes break to actually do that. And then we'll come back for Q&A. So we should finish around 12:45, 12:30, and then we break, and then we come back in the afternoon for a short session on failures. So unless you have any questions, as you know, we are very informal in this degree and in this area, and I'm really excited to get started so that we can get straight to the social entrepreneurs. I'm going to introduce them one by one. So as they come up, they'll do their presentation. I'll give you a little bit about their background, and then I'll introduce the other social entrepreneur. The other thing is, it's 20 minutes per presentation. I've given them a brief that you guys are quite sophisticated in your thinking. I hope. I've established some expectations. You understand words like business models, ecosystems. So we're trying to elevate that kind of presentation so that you understand the core of their business. So let me get started. I want to introduce you to both Camilla and and Nicola. These are Te Projecto. And I'm going to let them introduce themselves in more detail, but what's really phenomenal is the fact that they just won the Lush Prize for their organization. And in addition to that, Camilla was actually voted one of the top 100 young leaders of Chile in 2014, right? And Nicola, who's also on the board, and they're partners, so they're going to do a joint presentation, has had extensive experience in communications and development. So without further ado, let me introduce them. They will tell you about their organization, what they do, their business models, and very importantly, right, the golden nuggets for success. Okay? So let's give them a warm welcome.
We wanted to show you a video that explains a little bit about our organization first, and then we can discuss other details. So let me just press play.
The Protejo promotes a cruelty-free shopping lifestyle in Chile and throughout South America, helping to empower consumers and create demand for more ethical products. They see the certification of cruelty-free products as essential due to the lack of legislation regarding animal testing in the region. To achieve this, they have a number of campaigns. A printed list of cruelty-free brands available in Chile, also available as a free app, Viva Cruelty Free. Cupertejo's biggest event is Feria Ecobelleza, where more than 10,000 people and 60 cosmetic brands and sustainable ventures come together. Te Protejo developed a certification that confirms that ingredients and final products haven't been tested on animals, They are the only organization doing this work in South America. The Lush Prize funding will be used to expand Teplodeo's work through other countries across Latin America that do not have clear and reliable information sources on cruelty-free products.
Okay, guys.
presentation.
Okay, sure.
So I just wanted to apologize because I have amazing jet lag right now, so I'm a little bit slower. If you have any questions, well, I'll do my best.
And well, we want to thank you for inviting us. It's such an honor for us to come here and explain our organization. We've been working for 5 years, so this is like really important to us. So thank you.
So everything started officially 5 years ago. In my head, 7 years ago, I started working on another organization. It's called CODEF. It works on wild animal. So what I did there, I worked for about 7 to 8 years working with wild animals from Chile. We rescued them. We had a rehabilitation program. So I started learning about everything that I did had an impact outside, which I haven't realized it like pretty much yet, because I saw so many injured animals when they came into the rehabilitation center that I was like shocked, because every little thing that you do has an impact. So I became a vegetarian and started working and doing different things that I thought I had. I was more conscious about what I was doing. So at some point, I still got makeup done, I still got my hair done, I still wear shampoo and deodorant and other cosmetics. And I realized that they are tested on animals. So that's when I came with the idea of trying to have some research done, trying to see which organization or company or individuals are working on it on Chile, and find nothing. So that's why the idea came up. Okay, let's do something to inform people. I didn't know we were going to be here sending with you guys 5 years later. But it started from like a personal experience, and then Nicole and Daniela, who's our third director, joined the organization. But it just started from a personal experience, and then it became what it is right now.
Well, Camila and I came from a background on advertising, and in my case, communication. So we know that these bold areas are very important and the power they have to change people's minds.
So in that scenario, we both, just like Nicole said, I've been working in marketing for 8 years, Nicole, 7. We've been working from like a very young age, so we have a lot of work experience in a lot of areas. So with that in mind, we started seeing, okay, what can we do and how can we do it? If we know that the marketplace is so important and consumption is so important, we realized that we wanted to create an impact on consumption and to give awareness on responsible consumption to make a market change instead of making some other kind of activism or working around government or doing any other activity that many other organizations do. So I think it's very important that as a difference from us to any other animal rights organization, we are working from responsible consumption, and everything that we do is based on that vision. So I just wanted to ask you, so you can understand what happened to me too. I'm going to give you just a minute to think, how many products do you have on your bathroom? Just count them a little bit, like shampoo, conditioner, face cream, body cream, shower, gel. I mean, just give yourselves a minute to think what's on your bathroom, just in your bathroom. And you have a lot, right? Maybe 5, 10?
40.
5, 10? Just in the bathroom, right? The guys always say to me, no, we don't use cosmetics. And I'm like, really? You don't shower? You don't use shampoo? So at least the guys, probably 4, maybe 5. If you use things or your hair, maybe well up to 7. like in average, a girl has uses every day between 15 and 20 products. If you get makeup done, that can go up to 25 every single day. And if you have 25 shades of lipstick, you can have 50 or 60 products in your house for one person. I mean, and guys, they always say to me, no, that's not my problem. They use from 5 to 10 products. If they do just the basic stuff, nothing else. So imagine, I mean, this is a huge market. And just in the United Kingdom, it's a $9.4 billion enterprise a year. This is how much money the United Kingdom makes a year in 2016. And just to have a comparison, Chile is number 2 in South America. Brazil is number 1. It's a little bit less than United Kingdom, as you can see. We have a business market of $3 million a year, and Brazil has one of $2 million. And the funny thing is that the whole population of Chile is less than the population just in Sao Paulo. So imagine how much we buy on products. It's just ridiculous. Our market, we spend a lot of money on cosmetics in comparison with another South American countries.
So, well, with this in mind, we were thinking, okay, we use 25 products per day. What about the ingredients on those products? And what about the laboratories that produce these products? So we came with this problem. There are animals that have been killed for testing these products. So it's like 100 million per year in cosmetics and in medicine also. But we thought, hey, this is cosmetics. We don't need the animals. Can we do something?
And yes, other people thought about that too. 20 years ago in Europe, actually, there are a couple of very, very old and experienced organizations. You can see this map right here. The places that are marked in this dark...
Oh, everything is the same color here.
But this dark gray is the places where there are organizations working against animal testing in cosmetics. The ones that are tainted, like this little blue kind of... They have legal regulations, so yay! Brexit, no. So the European Union has a regulation, as India, Israel, and Norway. So that's good, but in China, they still require to test on animals. So a lot of big companies, they have sales in China, are still testing. So. For us, there's for everyone that works in this industry or business, we care about not just the product that is not being tested on the country, but the company doesn't have to test in any country. So we have, regardless of the fact that we have actually a law bill in Europe that doesn't prohibit the brand to sell still in China, because it gives one piece of paper to Europe legislation and one piece of paper to China, a different one, of course. So all of these organizations are working, and we're one of them. And actually, this is marked gray from like 2 weeks ago that we joined an international organization that's helping us out with the work. But before, Chile didn't exist in this map. Chile has had... and it's funny because we're number 2 in cosmetics, so we should have been there for so many years. But this is the actual reality. And the percentages that you see here are the percentage of people that supports this type of bill. And we still are in debt with our percentage. We hope it's over 80%.
So that's why Te Protejo was born, to protect animals, you know, to teach people what brands don't test on animals, and to teach people to buy cruelty-free products. So in 2012, there was no trustworthy source of information. In our country, there was no regulation about the use of animals in cosmetics, you know. There was no clarity of what brands were sold in that country. There was that was not tested on animals. And we are victims all the time of greenwashing, all the time. So we were thinking, okay, we have to do something.
So our main goal is to get you to stop using cosmetic testing on animals. Like you guys, stop it, please. So, and how are we doing that today?
Well, one of our biggest areas is information to the consumers. We are working on social media, we have a website, a blog, we have an app. We give the information on printed lists with animal, with cruelty-free brands to people. So we're trying to get them any way we can and teach them to buy cruelty-free.
What we also want to do, and it's very important to us, is we can tell you, hey, there's this couple of brands that are cruelty-free, but you have to drive 2 hours from your house to buy them. We know it's hard. We know that people want an easy choice. So one of our main objectives, along with information to consumers, is make it available just around the corner. So how do we do that? We have 3 main areas that are based in our business model. The first one is we certify companies because we need to have more options. So as long as we certify companies in Chile, we're going to have more options for the public and there are going to be availability for the brands. The second one is we create events, as you saw on the video. We have this Eco Beauty Fair where we not only project the cosmetic brands that are certified by us or certified by other organizations, but also other entrepreneurships that are based on recyclable materials, vegan products, products that are handcraft. So it's very important for us that people that are caring about cruelty-free cosmetics also care, just like we did, and just like I'm guessing you will or do, other kinds of products you want to buy to people who are producing in your city. You want to buy vegan products or products that are not affecting animals. You want to buy products from recyclable materials, for example. So we join them all in this big event of 70 brands, 10,000 people. We have sponsors. We have the free entrance. We have workshops. We teach them it's not just a fair to buy, it's a fair to inform also to consumers. So, but we do it like in a fun way when people don't realize what's going on. They just think they're going to buy some fun stuff and they end up with a bunch of information. So I think in the communications area, and we've been very careful with that, we are teaching you something that it's really hard and that people don't want to know. In a way that we're not showing you dead bunnies, because we don't like to see dead bunnies either. I mean, no one does. So it's a really hard subject that we are trying to approach it in a really positive way, and I think that's what's been making our business model so successful in that way, because people put like, they don't put hide in the Facebook wall, for example.
No.
So, yeah.
Well, yeah. Other thing that it's different about us, there is no other organization doing this work the way we do it, you know. There are different organizations that certify, for example, Living Bunny, it's one here, a big one here in Europe, or PETA in all over the world, but they don't do events like us, for example. They don't have different activities to educate or and inform consumers. So that's a brand of Te Protejo. And we are not working on 3 main campaigns. Of course, our Feria Eco Belleza is one of the biggest ones. We have 2 events a year in Santiago, and we also have events in other cities in Chile, one in the coast and one in the south. We are not working with Human Society International on a big cruelty-free campaign to support the bill to end animal testing in cosmetics in our country. And we did a several communication campaign, a lot of social media movement, a lot of press movement. We did an activity on the downtown in Santiago. We put 200 bunnies on the street, and we were informing people, hey, why why do you want to buy something just for an animal? This money can tell you. There's other options, you know, and that was really good.
That was so funny. People love the bunnies. So these are the golden nuggets. So first of all, I just wanted to say that we do make money. People think that because we're a nonprofit, we're supposed to be poor. For us, it's not that way. Because we're a nonprofit, we want to make a lot of money and make a good living for other people off of it. We want to make good with the money, not just have it. So our business model, as explained before, I wanted to just explain it a little bit more right now until we are going to Golden Nuggets. What we did is, okay, we have these three areas, right? We have the events. We have social media and communication to consumers. And we have these huge brands that are cruelty-free or another type of brand that follows our values too. For example, a vegan brand or someone that works with sustainability or any kind of product or service that comes with what we want to project. So what we did is with the events, we sponsor the events, just like Santander sponsored this. We handpicked which companies we want to sponsor the event. We chase them around like bunnies. And we get them to put money on the event. At first, it was really, really hard because our first event had 300 people. It was just a little bit more than this, what you're here. Now it's 10,000, so now it's much easier to sell the event. And then we sell the spaces for people to sell their products. So since we have a free entrance and everything is free for the audience, we have a lot of payments to do. So we have the sponsorships for the event and we sell the spaces to sell. We started with 10 stands. We are in 70 now. So it's a huge space now. It's underneath the White House of Chile. So it's a really important space in Santiago. So that's how we make money. That's 30%. Of our annual income, 30, 40, depends of how our losses are going, just like you're going to see in the afternoon, because we've lost a lot of money too. And then, you win it, you lose. And then the second one that represents maybe 10 or 5%, is the least, are the certifications. We charge so less, I mean, it's very little amount of money, just because we don't want ever to depend money-wise on the certification because we don't want ever happening that someone can say, hey, we are short of money to pay a salary. Why don't we just speed things up with these two brands that are coming up? We don't want that to happen. So it's maybe 2%, 5% of the certifications. Right now, it's 5%. It's low, but it's important. But at some point, we want to 100% not to depend on that money and just use it as a pillow fund and not to use it to pay anyone. And then the third one that represents the other 30% or 40%, it's the partnerships that we create with brands, with the bigger ones. So what we do there is to tell them, hey, you want us to talk about you? Pay up. So we charge money to talk about them or to do activities with them during the year. And so, but that's a little bit hard to keep it on a straight number. That's why every number that I've been saying, it's not like straight. Because sometimes we have these huge alliances and sometimes we got nothing because it depends on the economic year of Chile, which is low and high depending on the month. So, and the last one is things like the price, things like governmental funding, which, as you can see, it could represent 50% of the year, it could represent zero, because you never know if you're going to get funding from a project. Luckily enough, this year has been really good for us, so yay. So with that in mind, these are our keys to success. The first one is that information is power. And when you're shopping, you're voting. I don't know if you guys have in your head that when you're buying something, You're voting for that company. You're voting for what they are believing. It's not just buying a product. I mean, nowadays it's so easy to get really involved in consumption without thinking what it means. For us, it's so important for you to think more about why are you buying the stuff that you're buying. I mean, first of all, do you really need it? Second of all, if you really need it, okay, can you buy from a company that cares about their workers, a company that doesn't exploit animals, a company that it's good? Because it is important. It does make a change. It is one person plus one person. It becomes a $9.4 billion industry. So it is important. And that comes with that two concepts in mind. We get responsible consumption. And this is our number one thing. If you got a golden nugget, this is it. You don't need anything. The other things are important, but this is the most important thing. And the girl with the scarf, she knows what we're talking about too. So please keep that in mind, not just for your future projects, but for yourselves also. Second thing important that I think it's different, and it's because of our background with the goal, we get the money from marketing budgets. We don't get the money from responsible areas of the companies because marketing are bigger, because cosmetic companies need to get their products out there. So we were talking with Nicole, and she's like, aren't production budgets bigger than marketing? And then like, maybe they are. So we put one of the biggest. But I'm not sure. I think some companies have bigger marketing budgets than in production. So we chose to get the money from there. People always ask us, why don't you don't work with donations? We don't work with donations. We don't want your money. We want their money. And we want to help you guys with that.
Well, we also have 52 volunteers. Our organization works with people that give us their time for free. That's amazing. We have so many amazing people in our NGO. They work every day, like 3 in the morning, 4 o'clock, 8 at night. So our email is always working. It's crazy, but they help us, They go to the places and explain people why cruelty-free is important. They help us to support the bill, to get signatures. We are now around 40,000 signatures supporting this bill to end animal testing on cosmetics. So our volunteers believe in our project and believe in the power of changing consumers' minds. So that's really good. And we don't work alone. We have a free people director, We discuss everything together. No one can take a decision without, talking to the other two. And if the other two are not, you have to convince them. And there's nothing we can do if we are not convinced. So that's really important.
Yeah, we're lost. We're lost.
We have also other partners, We work with another organizations that share the same values that are ours. For example, a zero waste company that's called Fundación Basura. We work with vegetarian restaurants for our events, vegan restaurants for our events. So we share these values with another companies, and we work together. We have amazing partners, and we want them to be successful also. So it's like a really good partnership.
So, this is the last one. So we know. So this is our must-have. If you have a social entrepreneur, we thought hardly with this, so keep it in mind. The first one is be truly in love, committed, and passionate about your product. You're not going to sleep. You're not going to have friends. You're probably going to break up with your boyfriend. Because you give 120% what I'm talking about.
It's true.
She used to be married.
I used to be married. So, but it's such a cute baby what I have here. But it's true. I mean, if you ask any guy that has a business or an NGO or whatever that it's ours, there's their own, they're going to tell you the same thing. So I'm not joking. It's not an exaggeration. You have to give everything that you have until your hair starts falling down. And then there are going to be years and nothing's going to happen. And then it starts happening. So you have to be stubborn. You have to not listen to people when they say no. You have to be so in love with it. If you're not convinced that it's going to work, it's definitely not going to work. So you have to be convinced. And 100 people can tell you no. And when I started 7 years ago with the idea, I told my parents that I wanted to have people talking about cruelty-free cosmetics. And they were like, what? And I want to work with it. How? I mean, people thought we were crazy. And now they're thinking, like, how did you do that? So it's real. Everything that you have in your body, you have to give it to the project. And if you're not willing to it, you better go to home and get a regular job. And you're going to be happy anyways. So the second one.
That's yours.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Have meaningful relationships with your clients, partners, and collaborators. We've been... We know that sometimes you are so focused on selling or doing your business that you forget that you're working with people. And people have feelings. And people like to have relations. So we are best friends from everybody that we work. We don't have just clients. We don't have just people that provide services. Or we don't have just collaborators. We have friends. And if we messed up, we say, I'm sorry, and they forgive us because we care about each other. So sometimes when you have a client, you look at as an it. It's not an it. It's a him. It's a her. He has a husband. His son got sick. He's in the hospital. Or he's so happy and he got an award. You have to know these things because it's important when you call a client, hey, how are you? How's your son? Is he sick yet? Yeah, no, he's okay. I mean, you have no idea how much they're going to support you. If you have real, it's real. I mean, you don't have to fake it. I mean, it has to be real. Real connections with the people that you're working. Not just the people that give you the money, but the people that support your business. And the people that work around you also.
So you also have to define an editorial content and a graphic content. As Camila was saying before, you need to choose what kind of language are you going to use with your business. That's really important. And you must have a brand manual.
Please.
People must know how to use your logo, your colors, everything. And please be patient. Social media right now, it's crazy. People are going to be hateful, but you can do it. So be patient, you know?
The other important thing is constantly reinvent your business model. Sometimes you think you got it, and then 6 months, you don't have it anymore. It's important to have constantly meetings to see what it's working, what it's not. Because just like right now, everything changes so quickly every day. And it's important to be constantly wondering if you're doing the right thing or not. And if you have to change, don't be afraid to change the business model. Because it's not just one. Every company that has 30 years has changed their logo 25 times, have changed the logistics, have changed the way they make the money. And that's not wrong. That it's just perfectly fine when you are adjusting to new circumstances. And with that in mind, it's important to take time to plan the upcoming year. We have, right now, actually, last Monday, we have our 2018 plan. You have to plan what you're going to do next year, what you want to accomplish, what are your main goals and activities, because otherwise you get wrapped up in this do, day by day, and then you look back and you have no idea what you've done, why you've done it, and you end up doing something that had nothing to do with what you begin, just because you're so focused on moving forward that you don't know which way are you moving. So that's really important.
And you must have inspiration. You know, there's a lot of other projects, a lot of other amazing people. You must read about them. You must see documentaries, you know, get some inspiration to move you. Maybe they don't work in the same subject that you do, but they have like a business model that it works. So you have to research, you know, see a lot of that thing. And keep always a positive attitude. I mean, when you are positive, things can go really good. And
this I've heard separately from two incredible people that has huge businesses in cosmetics, and they told me the same thing. It was so funny. They said that when you work from your heart and in something that's good for the world, the money is going to come. So every time we don't have much money, I'm like, cool, don't worry, the money's coming. And the money comes. It's ridiculous. So it's true. I thought the girl was crazy the first time. The second time I thought, that's weird. And the third time when the money came, I was like, yeah, this is so true.
So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Nicola and Camilla. As someone with 50 products in my in my bathroom, I will become much more ethically conscious. And thank you so much for that inspiring talk. And there were so many golden nuggets. And in the end, we're actually going to open up for questions after we've had each speaker. I'm just going to get into the second, but thank you so much. That was so inspiring. I want to introduce you to Evelyn. Evelyn has a BSc in economics from Maastricht University, and she was a research consultant at the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, UNIDO. And she is, of course, ex-LSE or LSE for life, whichever one you want to say. What's really exciting about it is Evelyn is actually running an intermediary. And I know a lot of you are wondering, and I said this last night, where you can operate in the social entrepreneurship space, right? There are many different angles and many different locations. What's exciting is she has taken on the challenge with her company Salto Peru, which is a not-for-profit social enterprise that seeks to increase productivity in micro-entrepreneurs. So basically, she's an intermediary supporting micro-entrepreneurs. So this is going to be a completely different business model. The Tay Project too. So I'm not going to waste time. Let's get Evelyn up here. She's going to do her presentation. I'll tell you when it's about 2 minutes, okay?
Okay, great. My presentation. So first of all, great to be back here. Finished my graduate studies at LSE 2 years ago, so it's really interesting to see how everything is changing, and really great to be back. Salto was started, as I said, 2 years ago, and my co-founder and I, who's Peruvian, started actually with the basic notion of can the developing world solve local problems with local resources. So my co-founder and I have a background in development economics, and we're always discussing on the topic because it's something that interests us both. And my co-founder, who is Peruvian, when she went back after having been in Europe for about 7 years to her home city of Cusco, Peru, actually noticed that what you see in the newspapers, the big Peruvian growth, did not translate to those entrepreneurs that operate at the base of the pyramid. So the micro-entrepreneur, as we call it. So to discuss this concept a bit further, I will introduce you to Juliana. Juliana is one of the entrepreneurs that we've been working with since starting Salto. And what Juliana does is she cultivates roses as part of a farmer's cooperative in a remote area nearby the city of Cusco. And she primarily speaks Quechua with her family and has a primary education level. Now, Juliana has a family to take care of, and she's been working in this company or in this cooperative for a few years now. They have a wonderful product. When we arrived, they just started working with the municipality who provided them with fitatolos. So it's basically a greenhouse, but then a more basic version of a greenhouse. So they had this really great product, but at the same time, they had very low and unstable revenues. The reason was because they were selling this great product at the local market about 2 or 3 times a week at the lowest possible price. So this is an example of one of the micro-entrepreneurial situations that Andrea, my co-founder, encountered in Peru. And this is actually, if you look into the Peruvian context, If you look into the Peruvian context, this is actually something that you can see on a much bigger scale. So if you look at micro-entrepreneurship overall, 96 of every 100 formal enterprises in Peru are micro-enterprises. So that's a very big number. And this is only the formal enterprises that are registered. I think many of you that have lived in developing countries or have visited developing countries will see this large base of self-employment or informal economy as it has a lot of different names in the academic literature. But this number is a very big number. And if you look at this number and this sector, the micro-enterprise sector, and compare it with the overall economy, you see that the growth, the Peruvian growth, has been focused on the much larger enterprises, and this big group of enterprises has been ignored or has stagnated throughout the process or has shown very little growth overall. And then Andrea and I, my co-founder, started looking into the problem, started reading a lot about the topic, as we're both more academic, have a very extensive academic background. We found actually that 80% of the micro-entrepreneurs hasn't followed any higher education. So this means that they might be able to read and write, but it also means that they don't have the business knowledge that you might learn in your bachelor or master's degree. So that's a very significant issue, because it means that they might not have access to the basic marketing techniques, or they might not have access to supply chain management. This is a big gap that's missing, and we wanted to address that, particularly so because over 2/3 of the labor force in the private sector gains its income from micro-entrepreneurship, so it affects a lot of families. And again, this is only the formal part. So we started thinking, how can we address the lack of managerial capital at the base of the pyramid? And this is where Paul comes in. Paul actually has a very interesting story, because he didn't grow up in Cusco, he grew up in a province in the Peruvian Amazon. And he actually grew up in a very impoverished area, has some years where he worked in illegal mining, actually managed to save up some money and moved to Cusco, where, again, through hard work, he was able to secure a place at the public university in Cusco. So when we heard the story, it was very inspiring to us. And at the same time, we were thinking, Paul has an aspiration to, at some point, go back to his native province and work on agricultural projects there. We're thinking, is Paul able to reach that with the resources he has now? And in that process, there are two obstacles. So first, Peruvian education is very theory-based, particularly so within areas that are not Lima, basically, so that are not the capital. And this theory-based education means that he might be able to learn the four P's and learn basic accounting, but he doesn't have the opportunity through university to apply that knowledge. So that's one issue. And then the second issue for Paul is that a lot of the good opportunities are still focused on those that have good connections. There's a lack of access for people like Paul to obtain the best internships or the best work opportunities. And we were hoping that through Salto or through a project, we could help him build up a better base. So we had these two players, the student with a lot of knowledge and passion, and on the other hand, we have the micro-entrepreneur who has also the passion to grow his enterprise, the need to grow his enterprise, but is lacking the knowledge to do so. And that's why we decided to match both players, as Nadia already mentioned, the intermediary role. So what we effectively do is we first train Paul in the theme of consultancy to micro-enterprises. We build up a very unique curriculum for that, but also help him train his soft skills. And the soft skills, they focus more on, is he able to present in front of an audience, We found that students, particularly so at the public universities, are a bit shy, especially in public, while speaking and convincing others. So that's a big topic that we decided to focus on as well. And subsequently to that, we will match him in a group of five students with Juliana, and then he offers them business consultancy. So first there's a month of analysis. He will ask a lot of questions to Juliana and her peers, and then subsequently help them implement it. So this is very important. What makes our model unique is what you can see at the bottom. So first, the customized service. With Juliana and her cooperative, we were more on the theme of marketing. So for example, matching them with local restaurants that are able to offer a higher price for their product. We worked on human resources because the cooperative was not functioning as a cooperative. We tried to ensure that they would work together to fulfill the demands of the restaurant or the hotels. And another entrepreneur we might focus on, for example, human capital retention, or we might focus on, for instance, assuring that he can comply with the demand, because that's an issue we might encounter as well. So that's the first distinguishing element. And the second would be learning by doing. So we looked, obviously, prior to entering the market, we looked into what are the current, how is this problem currently being attacked? And the prime stakeholder that was working on this problem was the government. But what the government was focusing on was giving them the knowledge, but then not continuing with it. So they will teach through a weekly workshop, they will teach the entrepreneur about the four P's, but then stop there. And that was something that was really surprising to us, because first of all, you have this massive knowledge gap between the entrepreneur and the information of the government. So you might be able to study it through that process, but taking it into reality, that's a very different thing. So what we tried to do in the 3 months that we implement the plan with the entrepreneur, we tried to take the entrepreneur along the way. So this, for example, in the case of Juliana, was really interesting because we worked on a Valentine's Day project with this cooperative. That was something that they hadn't done before. We saw this opportunity to create a better value added for their products on a specific day, taught them how to arrange flowers, had to Google that myself as well, because I'm not really creative with those with those things. So yeah, that was really interesting. And along the way, we took one of the members of the board of the cooperative along with the meetings that we had with restaurants, so he would get exposure to how to negotiate. So that was something very interesting to do, of course. And then lastly, going back to the original question, can the developing world solve local problems with local resources? That's exactly what we try to do here. So we integrate local resources like Paul, train them, give them the opportunity to work and implement and use their knowledge for the benefit of their community. So thus far, in the past almost 2 years now, we've worked with about 300 micro-entrepreneurs. This consists of individual entrepreneurs, but also of cooperatives that may consist of 25. We worked with one cooperative, which was about 60 entrepreneurs, which was quite intimidating at first. And we've worked with 120 consultants. And the results have, for the entrepreneurs, we focus on the case-specific results. So every entrepreneur that we work with gets a different type of assistance. So we go for every enterprise. How did this work out? Are there elements that we need to improve? And also for the donors that we work with, they prefer getting more of a narrative to the story rather than pure statistics, which was something that I wasn't used to coming from the more academic background. And for students, we focus for now on satisfaction. So in the beginning, we want to focus on how does our curriculum do. And in the long term, we hope to see what is the impact on their opportunities. But obviously, after 1.5 years, this is something we cannot assess yet. The positive news that we have seen is that up till now, about four of our students have started their own projects. So one of our students is from a community that does a lot of traditional weaving, and she's trying to use the knowledge that she gained through Salto and apply it through to the weaving techniques and selling beautiful products from her family. So that's really nice to see. And then from the idea to the social enterprise, as I mentioned, I started this project with a Peruvian friend of mine, or former co-student of mine, and I'm originally from the Netherlands. And this was actually very useful, because for me, I was obviously not used to the Peruvian context. And my friend, being from Peru, had the idea to set up a project, and then subsequently match that with my skills. So that's something I will mention later on as well. It's really important that your skills and your recent resources complement one another. Mm-hmm. So for example, in the Netherlands, there's much more of a network for foundations, and this is not the case in Peru, but in Peru, she had more of a network to create alliances. So this was something that really matched up well. Now for the motivations, for Andrea, the big motivation was helping, using her knowledge to help her community in Peru. And for me, my motivation is my passion for upward mobility, not just for people, but also businesses and countries at large. So that's the reason why I'm passionate about this project. And then just quickly going through how to go from the idea to the social enterprise. We started with some pilots in Cusco, first for the students and then for a matchup between students and entrepreneurs. We've started to scale within Peru, so now we're still based in Cusco, but we've been expanding from Cusco to the more remote remote regions that are more difficult to reach. We've done recently a very small pilot with Bogota in cooperation with the Pacific Alliance, so we're trying to see how we can expand the model in the most efficient way possible. And then the second thing is obviously the financial self-sustainability of it all, which is something that I will talk about in a bit. The social model, the pillars of the social models that I want to mention is first, strategic alliances. This is something you cannot do on your own. And for us, our alliances are crucial to be able to capture the talent that we work with. So we work with the micro-entrepreneurs through a connection with municipalities. And we work with the students to our connection with public universities. And for us, it's also really important that it's public universities. We've also gotten some interest from private universities, but in the public universities, you'll find more students that need these opportunities. So that's a really crucial element for us. Then the capacity building of the students is the second important element, to train them in these soft and hard skills. And finally, to capture the talent, which is also mentioned by my colleagues. So it's really important, particularly given the fact that there's no economic benefit for the student volunteers that we work with. It's really important that you have non-economic benefits that you can help them with. So this can be through inspiration, but it can also be through, for example, we work a lot with CV building and career development. And that's a way to ensure that the best performer consultants will continue to work with us to scale the project even further. Then the business model. So for now, we still primarily depend on donations, but we're working towards a cross-subsidy model where we offer a paid service to SMEs, so companies that have a bit more resources to pay for the projects. And this is something that we're currently working on building this up so as to make the model more self-sustainable. Then finally, the golden nuggets. I developed it into the three F's. I'm a bit structured in this, or a bit neurotic, I would say. So first, starting with family. With family, I mean the team within the organization, but also externally. So within the organization, first, as I mentioned before, it's very important that you have this complementary skill set. That, for example, in the case of Andrea and I, she had more of the local context, more of the local knowledge, whereas I had more of the resources to set the project up from here. Then capture and nurture talent under tight resources. That's something that I will also mention in the second part of the presentation. That's extremely important to look at other ways to inspire the people that you work with, to help the people that you work with, and to stay connected with them. And last part of the family part would be balance. So they often say that entrepreneurship is an emotional roller coaster, and this is definitely the case. But you also have to take into account that you're not in this roller coaster alone. You're stuck in the booth with a bunch of other people, and it's really important that emotional roller coaster does not go too crazy. Mm-hmm. So it's important to have balance for yourself. You will be always thinking about the project. Am I doing it right? Or at 12 at night, you might have an idea, and then you need to write that down, as my Chilean friends also mentioned. So that's really important that you have some mechanisms to work on that, and also within your team to have feedback mechanisms. So it might be that there's a meeting and you just don't agree with one another, and it's really important to learn how to communicate efficiently. For me, that was really difficult because I was more used to the European or especially the Dutch directness. So if I don't agree with something, I will say it, and then that should be clear. But working in South America was a very different yeah. I did a lot of research on communication techniques, and somehow I managed to make that work. Then externally as well, so as I mentioned, alliances are key, but also informal networks are really, really important. I think this is the case specifically, particularly so in South America, where you get a lot of things done through connections, and that's really important. That's why it's also important to have, if you're from abroad or not from the developing world, to work with a local partner always, I would say. Okay. Then I would say feasibility. So how realizable is the project? So I divided that into focus and future. So focus is more focus on the now. So stepwise growth, be patient, and be realistic as well. So sometimes you might have these really bold ideas that have come up, but they might be very disruptive for the organization, because you might put a lot of talent into that, which diverts the focus from the original project. So you might have really great ideas, but you have to be realistic at the same time. And then the response to external events, that was with that I mean more, you will get a lot of setbacks. For example, recently there has been a lot of political crisis in Peru, which, amongst others, meant that there were a lot of demonstrations and roadblocks in the Cusco area, which was very new for me and also very difficult to work with. But this had specifically an impact on our project. So because we work with the public university, this means that the university is closed and we have to come up with solutions, and we were not able to reach the beneficiaries that we work with, and this can be very demotivating. So this is something that thinking about, keep focusing on your goals will help. And with that, I also want to talk about future. Remembering the why is a big topic today, and that's for me, that's the only thing that keeps me motivated to keep remembering why am I doing this. It might be that there might be upsetting things happening, but always remembering that part is crucial. And then I would say flexibility of the model, but also of yourself. Flexibility of the model, use your design your model according to the needs of the local the local population. So with this, I'm trying to say, often you might have a great idea or product developed, but targeting that product is crucial to what you do, and pay attention to the local context. And then flexibility with regard to yourself. So For me, I definitely can say that I learned a lot in the past 1.5, 2 years. And I learned a lot particularly because I had to adopt a more open mentality that is, and I had to do a lot of personal development. So as I mentioned before, I was more used to the European working in the European context, and I hadn't worked in this case, Peru. So that for me meant that, for example, whenever we had to make an alliance, that I had to demand much more of myself than I would have otherwise. So in the case of working with municipalities, for example, the more informal events were much more important than I thought. I was more used to the, okay, you have a good idea, I like your idea, and we can implement it, and then that's it, that's done. But there's a lot more dancing events involved in South America. So, yeah, let's say I did a lot of salsa dancing over the past 1.5 years as well. Yeah, that's all.
Okay.
Thank you so much. I'm going to move on quickly to Ileana, the girl with the 2,000-pound scarf. Sorry, that's what you're going to be known as from now on.
Now the girl with the scarf.
Come on, seriously. She has, her credentials are as amazing as everybody else on this table. She did a double program in global media at LSE and USC. She negotiated mining negotiations in the UK. I'm so curious about what that is about. And she has a strong background in art, design, fashion. And what really excited us about having her here today is a lot of the times when you think of social entrepreneurship, you think of it being sort of on the lower end of the market. And the idea that someone is actually positioning a social enterprise in the luxury market is extremely exciting. So, Ileana?
Okay.
One is 2 minutes.
Perfect. Where do I... Okay.
Let me escape this.
Yeah, my Windows knowledge is not that great.
When it's 2 minutes, I'll do this.
Perfect. There we go. Hello. Hi, everyone. I'm here to talk to you about my company, Basilisa, and more specifically about having a social and environmental impact while creating luxury products. First, well, let me introduce myself. My name is Ileana. This isn't working. Yeah, there we go. I'm from South America. I was born in Venezuela to Colombian parents, but I grew up in Peru. And I created Basilisa with my business partner, Emily, who's Australian. And we, you're probably thinking, how did a Colombian and an Australian create a company in London? Well, it was because of LSE and pancakes and mimosas. So one unseasonably cold morning of summer, Emily and I were discussing winter fashion, and I mentioned how, being Latin American and being South American in particular, I love alpaca over cashmere and I will prefer it every single time, which prompted her to tell me about how her family keeps alpacas in their farm in just outside of Sydney. So, of course, this meant that we thought about how a startup would be amazing and we would have this wonderful alpaca products that we would source from indigenous communities. And as we spoke and spoke more about it, we realized everyone is doing alpaca already. So we were discouraged and saddened. And then I thought, wait, everyone does alpaca, but no one does vicuna. And Emily asked me a question, which some of you are asking yourselves now, which is, what is a vicuna? So this is a vicuna. They're really cute. So Latin name, vicuna vicuna. It's a South American camelid that lives in the Andean highlands, which span from Peru, Ecuador, Chile, Bolivia, and Argentina, with the largest population being in Peru. Its closest species are the guanacos, alpacas, and the most popular of them all, the llamas. But vicuñas, unlike alpacas and llamas, which are domesticated, are wild, like the guanacos. And they are twice as soft, the hair is twice as soft as cashmere and half the weight, which means that it is truly synonymous with luxury. From Spanish monarchs to Hollywood actors, the name of vicuña has always been associated with sort of like the grandeur of things. It is so recognized that in the 1950s, it made its way until one of Hollywood's biggest golden era films, which was Sunset Boulevard, directed by Billy Wilder, a scene which I will show to you right now. So...
Well, as long as the lady's paying for it, why not take the vicuna?
In this scene, William Holden's character plays... Well, William Holden's character is a down-on-his-luck writer that gets a new suit from his benefactress. And the tailor is quick to point out, like, the best suit that you can get will be one made out of vicuna. Mm-hmm. So, sorry. But what makes it so special? So I've narrowed it down to what I like to call the three E's. First of all, it is exclusive. It takes the hair of six vicuñas to make one raw kilo of hair. So, and actually only 65 to 70% of that is usable. I'm going to get technical here. I refer to it as hair because although people are quick to categorize it as a wool, it doesn't actually fit the wool parameters. So it needs to be classified as a hair when you go through customs. Right, carrying on. It is a protected species under the Washington Convention. Which means it requires a lot of paperwork. But this is important, not only conservation-wise, it also provides traceability, which underscores its status. Second, it is expensive. So 1 kilo of raw hair fluctuates at the $600 mark, which means it is 8 to 10 times the price of cashmere. And it is extraordinary, because it is the softest and lightest animal hair. Again, getting technical, cashmere is around 12 to 14 microns thick. Vicuna is 8 to 10 microns thick. And in this case, thinner is actually far better. But after going on and on about why vicunas are so wonderful and so fabulous, I should point out that this is a social entrepreneurship master's degree, and this is the part that would interest you most. So this is how vicunas can create social and environmental responsibility. First of all, the fact that I'm talking to you here now is the result of a conservation success. Poaching and, you know, the desire to have the vicuna made the species almost go extinct from the 1970s to the 1980s, which prompted a huge conservation effort and a trade embargo. This led to a very limiting sort of trade of it. And at the same time, it created a governmental campaign that I don't know if it was the same in Chile, but like in Peru, I still remember the slogan to this day was Vicuña trasquilada, vicuña salvada, which roughly translates to a sheared vicuña is a saved vicuña. But this had great repercussions in the fact that in the late 1980s, in Peru, only 1,000 animals remain in the wild, and now there's 100,000 of them. What this means is that it can be a sustainable development opportunity because it is basically rekindling an almost lost industry. The international governmental efforts have made it possible for indigenous communities to do a traditional chacu, which is the ceremony in which they shear the vicuña. And from the sale of the hair, they have additional income that is hard to come by in remote areas of the Andes and where every dollar goes a really, really long way. Right. But having explained vicuñas and the interesting and amazing opportunities around them, I have yet to say what my company actually does. So Vasilisa combines the British weaving tradition with vicuña to create sustainable and ethically responsible luxury garments for discerning customers around the world. But how did we actually get there? So from brunch to reality. Mm-hmm. The first step was research. We knew that creating a business takes effort, and in order for it to be successful, it requires a demand. So we needed to look at the market opportunities. We knew that it was historically relevant, and we knew that it had a black market, which would suggest there was a clean market for it as well. On top of that, the luxury goods market amounts to $212 billion US dollars a year, That's the estimates for 2017. So the potential clientele is there. Next step was looking at competitors, and we discovered the Italian brand Loro Piana had negotiated an exclusivity agreement with the Peruvian government, which made them the de facto suppliers for the international market of Vicuña. This agreement expired in 2013, but Loro Piana still has the monopoly. So this means there was room for another competitor. But it also led us the way of thinking, why in 3 years has no one come up with a new company? So we looked at the barriers to entry. The biggest one, the exclusivity agreement, had already expired, which was a window of opportunity. But then we were faced with the logistics of it all, the access to the Washington Convention permits, the access to the communities, the access to the people in the Peruvian government, which is the authority is called SERFOR, which controls the permits. All of this is an arduous process that will deter anyone that knows better. We were fortunate enough to be very naive about what we were doing. So we just kept going on. And then, again, fortunate enough, then we knocked on the right doors and people were very receptive of the fact that we were just keen to make something work. Then we thought, is it possible? And we were like, it is. Anything is possible. But how could we be different? And this is very important in the luxury sector, because luxury is not something that exists. Luxury is something you create. So we decided that our product would be a limited collection on a yearly theme, which would set a which give us a differentiating point from other products that would be similar to us. So having decided what we wanted to do, we discovered the Generate competition, and you will forgive my plug here of LSE. I am also an LSE grad, and I feel like this competition actually did help. I highly recommend it, because having to write it out academically will make you think about things that you weren't thinking about when you were designing your business model or your financial plan. And if you get to the final round, you will pitch to people in the industry who will ask you questions you were not foreseeing. And it is mostly a safe environment where you will get really good feedback that you can incorporate to pitches to investors. So take it as a practice run. And now with the advertising out of the way, I will tell you about our development. So first, after we decided to carry on with our project, I took a trip to Peru, trekked the Andes, and met some communities. I also spoke to the Peruvian Environmental Agency, which is called SERFOR, and built all the contacts I could. Not only in the Vicuña business, but also with hoteliers, attorneys, customs agents, historians, lawyers. I'd be like, I don't know about you, but I usually think of a company as the product, and I always forget all the other elements that go into it. And that is just as important, especially when you're creating a company. So then there were the samples, which was trial and error. And it's an ongoing process, and it goes hand in hand with your brand creation, which De Protejo mentioned to a point, and it's true. You need to know your brand manual, and your brand manual and your product need to match, and each one has to be representative of the other. If you have a mismatch, you have failed in your brand creation and need to go back to the drawing board. So along this process, we always thought, how can we do this better? And how can we do this faster? Because neither Emily nor I come from a business background. I come from a film background, and Emily comes from PR. So every time that we were faced with something new, we knew that we would do it, and that along the way we would learn how to do it in order to the next time do it properly and faster. And now this sounds very mean, but this was an advice given to me by a professor at USC. And it is important, he says, that in creative industries, it is very important to kill your babies, because you will be enamored, madly, deeply in love with your product. You will make and go to extreme lengths to make it succeed. But at some point, you need to sit down, look at it and say, is this actually beneficial for my company? Is this actually something that requires the effort? Is it worth it? And sometimes it isn't. Sometimes you can't force things and you need to be rid of it and move on with the products and your projects that actually are beneficial to your company and stand in the line of what you're doing. So this brings us to the process. So we very conservatively are anticipating an 8-month production without sampling that will make 100 items. So hold on, I am lost in my presentation. Okay. So this is, but what is this product? What are these 100 items? The 100 items are 100% Vicuña scarf. That is a yearly collection of limited edition capsules with 100 items all numbered, which means that only 100 scarves will of this particular design will ever be made, which creates the allure of exclusivity. If you don't get it now, you'll never get it. But how is it profitable? Making, I get this question a lot, saying like you make 100 products and how is your company going to go in, you know, into the black? Well, the thing is, Vicuña is very expensive, mm-hmm. as Nadia keeps saying.
Can you tell them about the gold edged?
Oh, yes. One? So the first collection is gilded in 24 karat gold. And that's the, how it's the signature. This year is based on, I wasn't going to get into it because it's too long, but it's based on the Empress card, and the collection is called the Empress, and it's gilded in 24 karat gold that matches the whole product. So, how is this profitable? Again, Vicuña is very expensive. And the thing about the luxury market that is very different from other markets is that it doesn't receive its price from its cost, but from its market value. So you have to be really special to stand out because your consumers will have seen it all and then some. So you need to know what it is you're doing, and you need to be able to like transmit your ethos and what you're saying and to explain why it is so precious. With Basilisa, we are going on the traditional route of selling to retailers, which means pre-sales, which in our case is very beneficial because it gives you working capital. Because you usually, in fashion, get an advance of 40% to go into production by the retailer who's engaged you. This 40% can fluctuate. It depends on your negotiating skills, your luck, and how established you are as a brand. But the advances are working capital, and with 40%, you can get easily like 70% into your production. So we have 100 items that we are pitching to 35 retailers starting on December the 4th, as well as private clients. There's safety in numbers, so we like to pitch to as many people as possible because we only need one person to say yes. And after that one person said he says yes, the other yeses will follow. So do not be discouraged if you get the phone thrown at you or like emails never responding, because trust me, I've gotten like thousands of those. So this point gives me a good transition to the pro tips, which is the general advice that I have gotten from my friends, from professors, family, random strangers, books, etc. The first one is bootstrap for as long as possible. The longer you can keep your capital expenditures to a minimum, the easier it will be for you to increase your valuation. And this will translate into more control of the company once you get outside investors. When you have a product that is creative like mine is, you really, really want to keep control, because the moment you start getting stakeholders involved into the bottom line, you will start to compromise your quality, you will start to compromise your design, you will try to appeal to a broader audience, and that might go against your brand. And once it starts going against your brand is done. So know how much your company is worth and have quantifiable proof. Check your financial model. Investors get the financial model first, they always just turn to that page with the Excel. They need to know that the numbers close. They need to know that they add up. And if you don't have quantifiable proof, ideas are great and they're wonderful. But unless you can show that you've developed them, there really is nothing to them. And also, investors are pitching, they're investing in you as much as they're investing in your product or your company. So you always need to represent your brand and like be a quantifiable proof. You're an asset as well. So the MVP, which is not the most valuable player, but your minimum viable product. have a sample. In my case, it's a sample. If it's an app, have a working prototype. If it's a service, have an alpha testing. Have something that you can show investors and like they so they can buy into the idea. And then know your elevator pitch, which is one sentence of what your company does without saying how it does it. And tell it to every single person that you know. The best contacts that I've gotten in my life have come from randomly telling, like, yes, oh, I'm working with Vicuna because I want to make luxury products. And people saying, oh, you should talk to my uncle because he is so-and-so person in the Peruvian government. Or he is so-and-so person at customs in the UK. And I'm like, great, get me in touch. And people are actually really nice about it. Then, same advice as you gave, be naive about the journey. Disregard the naysayers. People who are in the corporate world know the barriers. They know the obstacles that are coming, and that deters them from venturing out in their own, although they would really like to. But I didn't know what I was getting myself into, so I didn't know the obstacles. So I always just assume, oh, after this one, it'll be done, and I, you know, won't have to deal with another problem again. And then it got to a point that I was like, I've done this for so long and so far that I can't very, you know, I can't very well stop now. So with this advice that was given to me, this is the advice that I'm giving to you. My golden nuggets, or what I like to call them, how to cut corners gracefully. So the first is, good advice usually costs coffee and a brownie. I kid you not. You can get any of your corporate friends, you go to LSE, you will have thousands of them. All of them will go into like McKinsey or JP Morgan. All of them like what they do, know what they do, but really don't like their jobs. And they are happy, but very, very happy to look at your project and say, this is what you need to do, this is what you can't do, this is how you can make it better. Outsource what you don't have. Borrow that financial model, find a graphic designer, call your friend with the really good camera and like the awesome Instagram account, and it will all come together by pulling favors. And then, like, you know, they will call you later for something else and you will pay them back happily. So have a simple financial model, because, I mean, as I said, I am no financial wizard. The most finance that I've done in my life was budgeting shooting days. It's really not that great. But I can explain my financial model really well to anyone who will ask me. And because it's super simple, and it actually attracts investors, because simple financial models mean that it doesn't need tons of variables and tons of investment for it to work. So people are more keen to continue a conversation because they can see it faster. Have something tangible to show. People are wonderful, but people, what makes them wonderful is that they come from all different backgrounds and have very different reference. So, and sadly, some have very little imagination. So I guarantee you that you will explain something to someone 1,000 times and they will be like, yes, I get it. I see it in my head. It's wonderful. And once you show it to them, they will say, oh, I was imagining something completely different. And with that note, thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Liana. Now we have Ken Banks. Yay, exciting. Ken is, how do I explain Ken? Ken is an award-winning social entrepreneur. He's a founder of Kiwanja.net, and the creator of a messaging platform, Frontline SMS. But he's so much more. Honestly, we did a competition recently where we designed a product and an app. And the truth is, after watching Ken's video, I completely changed my mind as to how that should have been designed and structured. He's really one of the key people bringing mobile technology into the four corners of the world, but doing it in a way that really disrupts, not in a way that we present sort of what we think it should be to those markets, but really doing some open source projects. I watched so many videos, sorry. I'm getting really excited. But, okay, so rather than hearing me speak for Ken, let's have Ken here right now. So can we give a warm welcome to Ken? Yeah, it should be Alt Tab. All the slides are here.
Okay.
Yeah.
There it is. There. And view, full screen. There you go. Okay. So I didn't study at LSE. Sorry to say, my big mistake. I'm also the only man on the panel, in case you hadn't noticed, because it's quite a big deal these days.
A rose among thorns.
There you are.
Or a thorn among roses.
I'm going to talk about something that none of you are going to be able to escape from if you go and follow your journey, and that's the environment in which you're going to be working. And I spend a lot of time trying to figure out the dysfunction and how we can make things work better, because if the environment's wrong, then it makes it harder for you to succeed. And if you do succeed, you can actually succeed and also destroy other people in the process, and it's important that you remember that. So I guess as a starting point, how many people in the room here feel that this is probably the best time ever to be doing this type of work? Do you have that feeling? Right, it's interesting, because you're in luck, really. If you listen to what USAID tell us, at least, that they would say that for the first time in history, we do actually have everything we could possibly want in place in order to solve problems that have existed for a very, very long time. And I actually believed this myself for quite a long time as well in my journey. But if you look back historically, it's quite interesting. So USAID are saying that now, but in 2005, Jeffrey Sachs said, for the first time in history, we have everything we need to solve all the problems that exist in the world. And that was 12 years ago. In 1949, people thought that we had everything we needed to solve all of the problems in the world. And so the more I sort of start to think about this, the more I realize that although we feel incredibly empowered with technology, the internet, the reach of everything, this huge interest in social business and social entrepreneurship and a passion for people to do good in the world, and maybe there are more people in the world today trying to fix things than there have ever been, the environment we're working in doesn't really, maybe in reality, isn't really that different to perhaps an environment 60 years ago. So what's been going on? If we had everything we needed 60 years ago to fix everything, why are we still having to fix things? And so these are the kind of things that I spend a lot of my time quite geekily kind of thinking about. So I suppose that the end message there is welcome to the latest for the first time in history, right? Just remember that this is not something that is particularly new. And when we think about technology, and that's where I come at this from, I've been working in technology for development for a very long time now, we can do some pretty amazing things that we've never been able to do before. We can do eye tests now using smartphones. We can equip community healthcare workers with smartphones who can run around in rural areas and they can detect cataracts and do all sorts of amazing things that were never possible before. We have things like this coral bot. This device detects dead coral and it's able to transplant live coral where there is dead coral. And I assume, of course, that the environment the coral's living isn't totally screwed, because that new coral is then going to die as well. But once you get to the point where you've kind of solved that, this can rectify that. We can track elephants. We can follow elephants around the African savannas. We can do it in real time. We don't want poachers to know that. So there's a lot of issues around who has access to information and so on. But we can track where elephants go, and we can mitigate against human-wildlife conflicts and other such things. We can even track bees. I mean, this poor little bee has got this thing stuck on his back. And when we're thinking about trying to study things like colony collapse disorder, and I think one of the biggest, most worrying things that not enough people are thinking and talking about is the collapse in insect populations and pollinators, because if we lose bees, we're in big, big trouble. And in California, in fact, they have to fly in bees. Beekeepers fly in their hives and they let their bees pollinate a lot of the crops in California, because in California there are hardly any bees left. So that's just an aside thing there. We can also plug things into our bodies and we can measure almost everything about us, things that work well, things that don't work well, in real time, and we can adapt our behavior around that. We can monitor and track and improve deforestation in Brazil and other areas where there's forest under severe threat. And we can throw drones up in the air and do aerial surveillance. And I mean, it's incredible, right? A lot of this stuff is relatively new. So in the first time in history kind of context, it does feel like, again, we have these things that do these quite amazing stuff. And we can 3D print limbs for people who've lost limbs in war zones and so on. So brilliant, absolutely brilliant. We also have people like Eric Hirstman here. Anyone who's done anything looking at Kenya and technology would know the iHub, would know Ushahidi, would know BRIC, this whole kind of Silicon Savannah ecosystem, which has erupted really in Kenya and is driving a lot of the tech stuff in Kenya. Eric is behind most of those things, and he's an entrepreneur and a businessman who's doing some really quite interesting things. This is also this is another friend of mine. This is Bridge Kothari, who's been developing language subtitling in India. And these are all featured in my books, these stories, so I won't go into any huge detail because there isn't time. But Bridge has developed an innovation which is helping 300 million school children in India learn to read. It's quite incredible. And then we have Laura Stacher, who runs an organization called We Care Solar, which is providing solar lighting to maternity wards in developing countries where the maternal death rates are horrific. I mean, really quite horrific. But then there's also people like these Nigerian schoolgirls who don't have power at school. The lights go out, they can't study, so they've built this urine-powered generator. You didn't mishear me. It is a urine-powered generator. There's clearly no shortage of that in Nigeria or anywhere else you would care to go. But this is a problem they face, and they've gone out and they fixed, found a solution for it. This is a guy who cycles around in Uganda, who requires his phone to be fully charged in order to get business and to drive his business. So he's adapted this dynamo, which usually powers a light on the front of the bike, to keep his phone charged, right? Again, he didn't go on a course to do this. He didn't go online to figure this out. He had a problem, and he decided if he didn't fix it, nobody else was probably going to fix it for him. So he went out, and he might have burnt through a few phones in the process, but he got right in the end. And then this 9-year-old Kenyan schoolboy who looks after his parents' cattle, who were being picked off by lions and other predators, and it's clearly a big deal if you lose some of your cattle. So he's developed this detection system that goes around the fence, which alerts him when something is trying to break through the fence. I have no idea what he does then when he faces a lion or anything, but he now at least knows that there's something there. This kid is 9, right? And I see so many people on this side of the world, if I can describe it as that, as people finding excuses for not doing things. If a 9-year-old with no resources and probably very little education can do this, nobody here has any excuse whatsoever. So I would add people to that quote. I would say that for the first time in history, we have the tools, technologies and people to end extreme poverty. And many of those people are in this room, right? There are now huge numbers of individuals, concerned citizens who see things that are wrong in the world and they want to put them right. And for me, that's the most exciting thing. I meet so many people these days who are doing this. 20 years ago, you just didn't have this, right? And maybe the technology has helped, but it's certainly for me all about people. When I think about my journey, this is a picture I go back to a lot. So I got interested in development in 1985 during the Live Aid concerts. And me and Harry having a quick chat earlier that I often speak to people who weren't even born in 1985. And I start to feel really, really old. But I come from Jersey in the Channel Islands, which is it's a financial kind of tax haven place. It's quite a lovely environment. It's small. Everything runs really well. It's quite a privileged place to live. And I saw Live Aid, which looks at the Ethiopian famine, and just thought, my God, we live on the same planet and these people are dying of starvation and we have everything that we want. What is wrong here? So I just got really interested in trying to understand what life is like for those people and why is the world so dysfunctional and broken that allows this to happen. So I, in 93, started going to Africa, and really I didn't go to fix anything. And I think that's the first most important piece of advice that I always give people. When you start your journey, don't go looking for something to fix. Right, go out and learn. Have a totally open mind. I spent 12 years learning. From this point to the point I actually built something useful was 12 years. Now, I'm not suggesting you waste 12 years of your lives. I wasted perhaps, but the product I ended up building did work incredibly well because I think I spent 12 years sitting on the ground with communities and just really slugging it out to try to understand what is life for communities like who are living on the edge of national parks, what is life is like for communities who are struggling to live on $1 or $2 a day, what is life like for women like these in South Africa who spend pretty much their whole time queuing up and collecting water and then taking it home and then going back and getting more water. You can read about it, you can see it on TV, but you go and sit there and watch it and speak to them and smell it and taste it. It's a very, very different experience. I fell into conservation initially, and I started working around Kruger National Park in 2003, and mobile phones were starting to appear around the park. And so, of course, people were starting to get very interested in what that meant for conservation and development work. And what it meant, in short, was for the very, very first time ever, conservation projects could directly communicate with the communities around the parks and communities that had a stake in conservation, but who had previously not been included in the conservation effort. Kruger National Park was created in 1926. Everyone was kicked out of the park, stuck on the edges, and nobody had spoken to them for 80 years. Conservation kind of did that. And it sort of started to come to its senses around the sort of 90s, 2000s, that actually we should probably speak to communities and we should probably engage them. Now, today it makes total sense that you should do that. You would never try to do that now without speaking to the people, at least in a democratic society. But back then, it wasn't the case. So I was looking at how mobile phones could be useful to communicate with communities around Kruger National Park. And what I found was that most people who were building things away from that environment were building highly technical tools. They were requiring tools that cost lots of money. They had 5-week training programs. And they required the internet in many cases. Now, you couldn't get on the internet in Kruger National Park in 2003, 2004. There are probably parts of the park where you still cannot get on the internet. And there are massive parts of the world where you still can't get on the internet. There are more people not on the internet in the world today still than are on the internet. So whenever I hear about amazing solutions to problems in developing countries that work off the internet, I immediately have a big flashing red light, because I wonder, you know, if your target market are smartphone owners with internet access, they're probably not the poorest people in those places, right? So again, there's a reality check there. So my solution to this was a really low-tech tool. Now, I could do programming, and I'd built stuff before in a commercial environment, but I came out with this thing called Frontline SMS, and the idea was that using a really cheap computer, which you could get anywhere in a local town, with a cable that you could get anywhere in a local town, and a, as you see, an old Nokia phone, but an old, very basic £10 smart dumb phone, you could connect this stuff up, and you could actually blast messages out through that phone using a piece of software I wrote for the computer. So you could create groups of farmers, healthcare workers, human rights activists, conservationists, type a message about a meeting, or it could be a water and sanitation alert. It goes out to all those people and they can reply. The replies come back into the laptop. So you had people sitting in mud, literally in mud huts, with one bar of mobile phone signal doing text message blasts to their communities. And the thing that really excited me about it was that I just gave it to them. I said, look, if you think that SMS could be useful to you in your conservation work or your health work or your human rights work or your agriculture work, here's a tool that lets you do that. I'm not going to tell you what to do because I'm a guy from Jersey who just had an idea, but this is for you to use and for you to figure out how you use it. So there was no training, there was no guides. People were just self-motivated to try to figure out how to make it work. And that I found amazingly inspiring. Within 2 years, it was used to monitor the Nigerian presidential election. So in 2007, a bunch of Nigerians picked it up. And for the first time ever, it's believed an African NGO monitored their own elections with mobile technology, which I think is a pretty big deal. Now, they sent me pictures of them doing this, and there were just beer bottles all over the place. I mean, it was a real kind of group get-together thing, and I couldn't really use anything in any kind of promotion, but the BBC got the story, and the BBC wrote about it, and then suddenly everyone got really interested in my work. But just bear in mind, it took me 12 or 13 years of learning. Then I wrote this in 2005, and it didn't actually start to do anything useful for 2.5 years. So for people that think we want to get to a certain point in a year or we've got to rush to success, sometimes things just take time. And I think your point about keeping costs low, not building up a big team of people, not getting a fancy office, not having all these high expenses, the reason I kept it going for 2.5 years was because I ran it out of my bedroom. I had no staff, no budget, no office. I did everything in the evenings and weekends. I communicated with the users through email. I fixed stuff. I re-released versions. And it was all done with zero money. And I wanted it to be that way, because the minute you take money from someone, the clock ticks. And that's not fun. You have to absolutely keep control for as long as possible, whether or not you're looking to get investors or other things. And interestingly, actually, in the current news, the first user I got within 2 weeks was from Zimbabwe. and it was civil society organizations trying to overthrow Mugabe. Now, again, if you think about how long that's taken, right, he's now gone, right? But he was there for a very, very long time. But again, the tool enabled people to communicate messages around that particular event. And here is the one in Zimbabwe, where the Movement for Democratic Change looked like they were going to win the 2008 election, and Mugabe crushed them, and they started burning people's houses. Anyone who'd voted for the opposition were basically persecuted. And so Frontline SMS was used to communicate messaging around what was happening in the country. I had no idea it was going to be used for that at all. In fact, I never thought it was useful as an activist tool in any sense. In East Africa, it was used to monitor stockouts of drugs, essential drugs, anti-diarrhea medication, malaria medication, where children were dying because they couldn't get access to these really essential drugs. So people were able to crowdsource where these drugs were not available, and it was mapped. And this map was actually used to lobby against governments in those countries who were saying that you could get the drugs you needed anytime you needed to get them. In Afghanistan, it was used to send security alerts to field workers who were running around Helmand province and other places, putting their lives on the line to try and help reconstruct the country. Communities in Vietnam, Cameroon, Nepal, Haiti, they started using it to run anti-trafficking systems. There were a lot of trafficking going on in their areas, sexual trafficking and human trafficking. And so they set up alert systems themselves because they saw that as a big problem in their community, and they decided that this was a tool that could help them mitigate against that. And then in Malawi, it started getting used to run community healthcare networks. This is a guy called Alexander who's running it out of a hospital, St. Gabriel's Hospital, just outside the capital. He's running a community healthcare network for 250,000 people through a £400 laptop, using text messages to have everyone chat and communicate. Nurses who were previously going on 5-hour bike journeys to give injections to patients who had died 2 days earlier were now able to check the patient was alive and where they were and get straight there and back. He was the only doctor at this hospital. When you have no resources, you've got to maximise the use of everything you've got, and SMS streamlined that for them. And what fascinated me, the software ended up being used in 190 countries, which is pretty much every country. The last survey we did, about 30 million people were benefiting through all of the uses of the platform in all of those places. But I did not design or come up with or get involved in any of those uses. For me, it was about empowering people with a tool that allowed them to do what they wanted to do. I think going back to some of the earlier points in some of the earlier talks, there are skills, there's capacity, there is a drive, there is a commitment, there's an ambition to fix problems in the places where the problems are. It doesn't need people like me to go and fly over there and fix them in many cases, and I'll kind of go back to that a little bit later. The thing about SMS, though, is it is old, it is dumb, it is simple, it is boring, it's the most unsexy technology you could ever come up with, and trying to convince donors who have lots of money to spend on really fancy things that actually SMS is probably the most useful thing is quite a sell. But if you could start to show them the kinds of stories that I've showed you and many others, and start to get stories from the users about how it's impacted them, then they start to pay attention. And we ended up raising, after getting no money for 2.5 years, ended up raising $3 million over the next 2 or 3 years from some quite big donors who got really inspired by what the platform was doing. And we were simply selling the stories of the people who were using it and then using that money to make the product better for them. Because if you think about where we live and where we are obsessed with the shiny, the new, the fancy stuff. If you ask most people what innovation is, it's iPads and iPhones and this kind of thing. And what happens is that if we get caught up in that mentality, we end up with a scenario like this, where somebody is talking in Addis Ababa about how African farmers can use iPads to get agricultural information. Now, trust me, if an African farmer has an iPad, he doesn't need your help. Full stop. And don't even start thinking about giving everyone iPads. That is an old model which should be dead. It's sadly not dead yet, because manufacturers of devices are trying really hard to, you know, why do Microsoft give so many free licenses away in these places? You know, it's not because they're necessarily just nice people. You get hooked in their products, and that's the end of you. And so we end up in a situation where people just come up with really crazy ways of using a new and exciting technology. This is an iPad-powered coffee machine. Actually, I overheard a conversation this morning. Someone was saying they've got loads of gadgets at home for making coffee. I didn't know if they had one of these. But why? Was it you? Yeah. Why on earth did someone build an iPad-powered coffee machine? Like, is the world any better because that exists? It exists because it can exist. right? I mean, there are lots of other much better ways of making coffee than this. And this iPad had to be bolted down in the end because it kept getting stolen from the reception area where the company had it. This, for me, is just the perfect example of doing something because it sounds cool and it feels innovative, but it really is pretty dumb and pretty useless in my view. And we also have, I think, in the environment, this constant obsession with challenges. And I know that somebody had mentioned a challenge earlier. I think it's a big problem when people are encouraged to come up with random ideas to solve problems that they've never seen or have no experience of. And it creates an environment where it lowers the value in finding a solution. And if you think about the open IDEO challenges where you throw an idea on a site and then it becomes a beauty competition, the more likes you get, you progress. It's not about likes, is it? Because it's if you've got more social media followers and someone else, you're going to win the competition, right? At least you're going to get further. It might not be the better idea. And what do half the people who are reading the site even know about this anyway? And a thing that really got me recently when I read this article, that there were 1,500 apps that have been developed for refugees. And I don't think refugees need 1,500 apps. Like, and why are we still building apps for refugees? Do they really have such specific needs that you need to keep building new things for them? And are we saying that out of that 1,500, none of them are any good? Because that's not surely not the case. So I'm just throwing this in because the environment that I live in and work in, which I think crosses over social innovation, social entrepreneurship, international development, it's now become one big blob, really. It's almost merged to the point of being hard to identify, which is different. We have a lot of this. And I think this is really, really dangerous, because we end up with lots of people running off in different directions doing things that end up really having no real value at all. And things haven't really changed a huge amount over the years. Earlier, there's always been a talk about there being too many pilots and nobody knowing what anyone's doing. Anybody in this room who does a pilot, do you communicate that pilot to others? Do you share it broadly? Is there a website you can go to which says, I'm doing a pilot and here it is and this is what I'm doing? Most people do pilots without really communicating very well what they're doing. So you end up with millions of pilots. And if you've got millions of pilots, how the hell do you control that? The Rwandan government actually banned pilots in health and mobile a few years back because they just could not track. Can you imagine if 500 Africans arrived in the UK and ran pilots with the NHS with mobile phones without telling anyone what they were doing? I mean, the NHS is mayhem enough at the moment without actually having that. But that's kind of what's going on. The failure thing is really quite a big deal as well, that we keep saying that, you know, you shouldn't be afraid to fail, but donors don't like people failing, right? And people are still afraid to admit that they fail, but you need to keep trying and you need to not be afraid of it. But it's hard to. So we've been talking again for 7 years about being more open about failing, but we're still struggling to be open about failing. The reinvention of wheels. Why are there 1,500 apps for refugees? Why are we still building things that already exist? Again, that's something else that's been around forever. So stop working in silos. We keep, again, if any of you go to these sort of events, you keep hearing we're working in silos. Healthcare workers are here, agricultural people are here, human rights people are here, mobile and health people are here. You know, and we're all, no one's communicating with everybody. Who's to say that you can't learn something from somebody working in a totally different sector than the one that you're working in? And then there's this whole kind of obsession with the latest technology, with all the shiny and new stuff. Going back to the earlier point, in many cases, that stuff is completely useless for probably 60% of the planet. So thinking about who your market is really important there. And then there's the whole capacity building thing that, you know, why is it us doing this problem solving and not people in the countries themselves when we think about the presentation that you gave? Only 1% of aid money goes to humanitarian organizations in the places where the problems are we're trying to solve. Did you know that? 1%. How shocking is that? Like, that's immoral, I think, actually, more than anything. And the excuses that are given for not being more than that are horrifically boring, stupid excuses. What ends up happening is, and I got this from a report earlier this year, in North Carolina, there are 26,000 jobs being created in global health, $1.5 billion in wages. That's been created in North Carolina for global health problems. Does North Carolina have malaria? Dysentery, diarrhea. I mean, like, why isn't that across Africa? So I'm just throwing that out there just to make you think about this is the environment that we're in and this is the motivations people have, and a lot of it is wrong, and either you can choose to go along with it or you can choose to challenge it. And I I obviously choose to challenge it. So very quickly, and there's more this afternoon on this, the reason why I think what I did worked and why, if any of you are working on technology things, it might work. If people do have to get equipment or buy things to use your product or service, make sure they can get them locally. If they can't get them locally and have to buy them online, you know, forget it for most people. It just doesn't work. If people have to plug stuff together, it's a maker type thing, again, make sure that they can look at it and it makes sense what they're doing. If you give somebody a laptop, a USB cable and a phone, even if they're not technically literate, they will figure out within a few minutes how those three bits plug together, and that's how frontline SMS works. This is a really massive subject, but cost, price, how you become financially sustainable. I chose to give my products away for free. In a way, now I wish I'd done it differently, but it did create some quite amazing things, and so maybe I should just be happy with that. But it's a whole debate around how you create sustainability around a technology product or an app or anything that you're building like that. The ability for news of how it's used to go viral is absolutely critical, I think, because many of the people who are living in the places where I was trying to help don't have access to news and information on the web. It's word of mouth. It's a hospital telling another hospital that it's used the platform and it's managed to do great things, and that hospital then going out and doing it and then telling another hospital. When we got to 190 countries, we had no marketing budget. We never spent money on marketing ever. And we ended up in every country in the world pretty much through word of mouth. And it took a long time. But I'm glad we didn't spend any money because we didn't have to convince anyone to use the product. They all chose to use it because they saw value in it. And that's the best way, I think. Forget the internet. Again, people really hate that one because it throws up a whole bunch of other challenges. But if you can build a product that doesn't need the internet, then you're really onto something which can potentially scale and grow and replicate in ways that many other things can't. And in Zimbabwe, for example, when I was working there in 2007, 2008, only 3% of people had internet access. So if you're building a product in Zimbabwe, you're losing 97% of the population just through the choice of technology that you use. It's kind of staggering. Allow people to be able to share what they're doing, going back to that point about replication. And we had an online community for people that could get online. When I would wake up in the morning and see a user in Nicaragua, I just helped a user in Uganda solve a problem. That's bliss to me. I always think to myself, if I stop doing what I do tomorrow, if I just step back, bang, gone, will my thing survive? And I think it's something that everyone should always ask themselves when they're building something. If you stop tomorrow, what happens to my project? And if your project goes with you, you're doing something the wrong way. And my favorite Gary Larson cartoon, these community throwing or hiding all their high-tech stuff as the anthropologists arrive, try and look all kind of... But again, the silo thing I think is important. My degree is in anthropology, and people that, when I speak at tech conferences, can't believe I've never actually studied technology, anything. I've just learned about it as I've gone, and I've gone in the field and learned about it. So, and I self-taught myself the program. So again, I think for me, the focus is, at the end of the day, it's people that are using everything we're doing. Everyone in this room that builds something is almost certainly going to be used by people. And so anthropology is a brilliant thing to learn. If you're kind of thinking about what you should be studying or something else to think about studying, then anthropology is a brilliant one. And then Small is Beautiful, brilliant book written 35 years ago nearly about appropriate technology, still hugely relevant today. I would recommend it to anyone who is building any kind of technology for developing countries. And the whole appropriate technology Schumacher thing came out of this. And don't compete. This boy split in half because I always envisaged two health NGOs pulling the arm of one child, both trying to vaccinate him. There's horrific, horrible amounts of competition in social entrepreneurship, social innovation and development, to the point where people try to destroy other people to try and look better. And again, I just don't get that. I don't care if someone else has got a better solution to me. Good luck, take it. And I'll stand back quite gladly if they did. But egos are a massive problem. And the more you work in this, the more you will see. You can choose to get involved in that, or you can choose to ignore it. Over Twitter, I've had all sorts of horrific problems over the years from people who don't like my stance in this, and I choose to ignore them. I want to use my energy on things that matter. And finally, I think this for me is the real standout bit. We should only assume we're in a better position to help the poor than they are to help themselves if we have some particularly compelling reason for thinking so. I would start with that. Whatever you do or whatever you're doing, just stop and think about that for a minute. Why are you doing this? Is it because nobody there can do it? And what is your role, and at what point are you going to step back? Because, again, I don't think enough people think about that. Thank you very much.